Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and Michael Riley is back with us today. He represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, arbitration, and it's always great to have him stop by. And he's with me in the studio to answer your questions. What do you want to know about car and home insurance? Join the conversation. You can give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Mike Riley, good to have you back.
Great to be here, Larry.
You know, I'm going to start with an email because it directly relates to what we're talking about here today. Lucia emailed. She understands that she needs to have car insurance when financing, but does it have to be the highest amount? That gets a bit pricey. So my question to you is, what insurance are car owners in Wisconsin required to have?
Sure. The first answer is we're a mandatory insurance state now. We all haven't always been. $2,550 is the limit. And when we say that, people say, what does that mean? Split limit policies are the most common. You see some single limit liability policies. A $2,550 means that if you injure someone through your fault, you have coverage for $25,000 for each person you injure, up to $50,000 for everyone that's injured in an accident. And that's the minimum. That is completely inadequate.
Yeah.
We had for a number of years, we were 100, 300, so 100,000 for each injured person, 300 for the total number of people injured. And even that, in this day and age, is certainly much better than the minimum, but not nearly enough. You know, we see cases very consistently, Larry, where an emergency room visit is $20,000. So if somebody goes into the emergency room, even if they're not seriously injured, they may be some concern about a head injury, so they run CAT scans or MRIs or whatever. And anyone who suffers any significant trauma and goes to the emergency room is going to run up a very substantial bill. And from there, obviously, if you have people seriously injured, I mean, medical bills can get to $100,000 or more, you know, very quickly. So, you know, I think that the first answer is that 100, 300 is the least I think anybody should have. Now, look, ultimately what you're doing is you're protecting yourself as well as protecting others. I think you have a responsibility to other people to afford them a reasonable amount of protection. People can say, well, I don't really have anything anyone can get. And if that's the case, you can say, well, maybe $2,550 is enough for you, but it's certainly not enough for someone that you might injure and injure severely. And the difference in cost to go up from, say, $2,550 to $100, $300 is not that dramatic. And you can shop different companies, and you should. You can go to an independent agent who represents a number of companies. You can probably go online now and look at different companies. I'm a fan of having an agent, either an independent agent or an agent for a specific company, because they can give you more information and talk to you a little bit more about what you need and why you need it. I mean, Liberty Mutual's got this thing now where they say, only pay for what you need. Well, what does that mean? You know, they don't offer any advice on that. And again, you can look at it two ways. What do you need to protect yourself? Well, it depends on what you have. What do you need to protect others? Well, to me, it should be at least 100, 300. And then if we want to segue, we can talk a little bit about getting an umbrella policy. I know there was a question about
that. Diane had a question that she said that her agent told her retirement savings could be lost unless she has an umbrella policy. And she did take one out. She was worried about her 403B and her 401 accounts and her equity in her house and personal savings and all that.
Right. And, you know, I don't.
What is an umbrella policy?
Well, an umbrella policy, first of all, is a policy, and it's generally liability, and liability insurance protects you against claims brought against you by somebody you injure through your fault. You know, if you're not at fault, you don't have to worry. But if you are, and that isn't always crystal clear either,
yeah,
who's at fault in an accident. So the bottom line is that an umbrella policy gives you more liability coverage. They're usually started about $1 million. They can go up, well up from there. But what you want to do, in my view, is check and see how much underlying coverage, that 25, 50, or 100, 300, or whatever is on your base policy. See how much you have to have in order to get an umbrella. And I'd say keep that, the primary policy, relatively low or as low as you can. And it's probably going to be at least 100, 300. And then buy an umbrella. The umbrella is much cheaper. And the reasoning's pretty simple. Part of what an insurance company, the big part of what they're insuring against, is the risk that you're going to have a claim at all. And so, you know, when you get to an umbrella, by that time, you not only have to have had a claim, but you have to have gone through that underlying limit, your primary coverage. So the chances that you're going to be in an accident that would require an umbrella policy are very small. Now, you can say, well, then why should I have one? Well, because there still is that risk. And if you have significant assets, as the person who sent the email did, certainly they can get at, you know, they can get at your savings, they can get at the equity in your home. You know, there are bankruptcy possibilities, but that's not something anybody wants to go through, especially after you spend a lifetime accumulating things. I'm honestly not certain. Some retirement savings, I believe, are exempt, but I don't know what the answer is that with respect to her particular retirement savings, and I wouldn't want to count on that, absolutely. So if she wants to call me, I'll give you a quick number. You can reach out to me directly, 608-698-1595. I'll do some more checking, and I can give her a complete answer. But the bottom line is, I think she had some concerns. Was she overpaying? I don't think so. I think an umbrella policy is relatively inexpensive, and I think it's a good investment for anyone with any meaningful amount of assets.
Got another question along a different line from Kirk in Madison. Let's go there. Kirk, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I'm in a neighborhood association in Madison, and we are incorporated. We were advised to get incorporated when we started the association. And an advantage of being incorporated is no individual can be sued for something that happens on a neighborhood association event, like if at a picnic and there are games and someone, you know, falls and gets hurt or something. No individual can be sued, but the neighborhood association could be, and that's considered very advantageous to be that way. So should the neighborhood association have insurance in case something like that happens?
Well, I'm assuming they would have insurance. We belong to an associate condo association. We certainly have insurance for the condo association, and I would think a neighborhood would be similar. I will say a couple things. This is a question that comes up again and again. I've got questions from, you know, organizations that, for instance, soccer clubs, you know, who are concerned about that. And I'd say, first of all, the level of risk is really minimal. It's not only whether you're holding an event and someone's injured. The neighborhood association would have to be at fault. I mean, the fact that someone is playing a game and falls down and hurts themselves does not make the neighborhood association liable at all. They'd have to have done something that was beneath the ordinary care that's required of everyone. And that really is pretty rare. Even for someone to bring a claim, people who sprain their ankles and probably even break a wrist don't bring claims. Now, if somebody becomes a paraplegic, you know, which is horrific, then you have, you know, something where someone might bring a claim. But again, I think the risk is pretty minimal. On the other hand, you know, even if you're not ultimately determined to be at fault, just like with any insurance, you know, if somebody brings a claim and ultimately sues you, that can be very expensive very quickly, you know, trying to defend that. And that's a big part of why you have insurance, is not only to protect you if you have done something wrong, but if you really believe you haven't, to defend you against those claims and pay the costs of doing that, which is primarily hiring an attorney. So, you know, I think it would certainly be a good idea for the association to have insurance, although I think their exposure is probably pretty limited. And being incorporated, you're absolutely right, is a smart thing to do.
Kirk, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, as we talk with Mike Riley. We've looked at neighborhood association insurance or homeowners insurance we could talk about, but we've zeroed in a bit on auto insurance with Mike. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. And back to driving for a second. There are penalties, and maybe what are the penalties for driving without insurance in Wisconsin?
Yeah, if you don't have insurance and you're in an accident, which is how they determine you don't have insurance, they don't, you know, run roadblocks and pull people over to check on your insurance papers. But if you are in an accident and you don't have insurance, you're going to be required to carry insurance before they'll let you drive again. And it could impact your license and your ability to drive, particularly if you're unable to pay a judgment that somebody obtains against you. So it really is, it's not only the responsible thing to do, it's the legal and appropriate thing to do.
I'm wondering about, let's take somebody then who is uninsured and runs into you and it's their fault. How do you protect yourself against and the person doesn't have any money? How do you protect yourself against uninsured motorists?
Yeah, that's a great question. Uninsured motorist coverage is part of every automobile insurance policy. So if you have, you know, if you have a policy with 2550 liability, you have 2550 in uninsured motorist. Again, as it goes up, 100, 300, 250, whatever, you have uninsured motorists in that amount generally. You should check to make sure that your uninsured motorist coverage is at least as much as your liability coverage. It's mandatory for the minimum. Not quite certain whether it's mandatory for the higher limits, but I've seen people who have lesser uninsured motorist coverage, which makes no sense. One, it's much less expensive than liability coverage. And two, it's what protects you and your family if you're injured by somebody who doesn't have insurance. Now, there's also, beyond that, there's underinsured motorist coverage. And we started off talking about how the mandatory minimum limit of 2550 is just inadequate. And if you have someone with 2550, they're not uninsured, so you can't collect from your underinsured. Uninsured's mandatory underinsured coverage, which is what you need for that, is not mandatory. So if you get underinsured motorist coverage, it has to be offered, but it's not mandatory that you accept it. You should accept it. Again, it's very inexpensive. I mean, the cost of obtaining underinsured motorist coverage is a fraction of the overall policy cost. And that's what protects you if you're injured and your damages far exceed the coverage the other person has. And that could be the minimum coverage, but it also, even if somebody's got 100, 300 and you have very serious injuries, that may not be adequate. And for literally a few cents a day, I mean, you can pick up underinsured motorist coverage. And I've seen so many cases, Larry, where people, you know, with significant assets and significant things to lose and have had injuries that dramatically impact their quality of life, and the person who injures them has inadequate coverage and they have no options. We had a case involving a farm family who owned a number of farms, really lovely people. One of the, I think the father was killed, the mom was injured very severely, and you had some kids who had like 100, were driving a car that was had the minimum limits, which I think were 100 at the time. And that was a fraction of, you know, the value of their injuries. Now, no amount of money you get for an injury is worthwhile. I mean, I've never had a client who wouldn't say, gee, put me in a time machine, run me back so I don't have to endure this, and please keep the money. But the fact is, money helps. I mean, in that case, the mom needed lifetime care. And, you know, having a significant, and they should have had an underinsured policy for at least $1 million and probably more than that. They had assets that were in the millions. And it would have made a real difference to the family in terms of defraying those costs. So it's very inexpensive. It's something really everyone should have.
I'm thinking about my own situation. I've got two cars. Two of my daughters got one, but she will occasionally drive my car for one reason or another. All drivers should be in a family, should be on the policy, I would expect.
Yeah, they are. The question that comes up sometimes is, what's a family member? And that's been litigated about a million times now. I mean, generally speaking, if you're all living together in the household, you're all members of the household, you're all covered under the policy. You have to make sure that they're not driving, that, For instance, your kid doesn't get a vehicle and not insure it, because then that's an owned, uninsured vehicle, as the insurance company say, and that might not be covered. But any vehicle that a family member owns living in the household, you know, is insured, that's going to be covered. That's, you know, that shouldn't be a problem. Questions arise sometimes when, if you have a kid away at school, if you have somebody in the military, and, you know, the question becomes, are they still a member of the household? If it's a temporary absence, but the household remains their primary address, they get their mail there, it's where they come back when they're, you know, through with that year in college or their stint in the military, they may still be covered. But again, that's something you should make sure you talk to your insurance agent about, and make sure if there is a question about whether somebody is a member of the household, make darn sure that they're covered.
Mike Riley, our guest today, great to have him with us. And we'll take your calls at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Greg in Winona, Minnesota next. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I got my homeowner's insurance bill a few weeks ago, and I'm trying to figure out what to do about it. But it went up 58% last year, and I understand that climate change and all of the fires and floods and whatever are in part causing this. And I know that the insurance companies are in a situation in which they're not making money at the moment. This kind of increase is going to force people out of their homes. And I'm wondering if we can expect this to continue for a while anyway.
Yeah. Greg, thank you.
Yeah, great question. I've been reading a bunch of articles on it, Greg, and you probably have too. I mean, an awful lot of this is, you know, the disastrous year they had in California, where they had fires, floods, mudslides, about everything imaginable. And of course, a lot of the coastal regions were hit by hurricanes and torrential rains and flooding. What seems unfair, honestly, and probably is unfair, is that in Winona, Minnesota, or La Crosse, Wisconsin, we should be paying for California or Texas or Florida. And yet that certainly in part is what's going on, and in significant part. A lot of the companies are actually pulling out of some of these states, which causes its own set of problems. And I'll talk about that in a minute, but let's talk about your problem. The first thing I do is I'd shop some other companies, and you may have already done that. Again, I always think going to an independent agent who represents a bunch of companies is worthwhile, but certainly you can also shop, you know, standalone companies, you know, the big companies like American Family, State Farm, a lot of those companies. But I would definitely go to different companies. People tend to think, well, they're all the same. They're not. I'm sure they all went up this year and probably went up significantly, but certainly you might find somebody. Underwriting standards just differ from company to company. So each company, when they take on a risk, they underwrite the risk. They have people who look at that risk and say, okay, you know, how likely it is we're going to have a loss on this risk. If we do have a loss, how big is that risk likely to be? And so another company may just take a different view of what kind of risk, you know, you create, and might give you a better rate. So I definitely do that. One of the problems that's also happening and is going to continue, I'm afraid, is most companies have a fund of some sort where they act as kind of the insurer of last resort. So if people can't get a policy, then they go to the fund. And, you know, if that were really just the state picking up the tab, it would impact us all as taxpayers, but it wouldn't really have much impact on the companies. The problem, and one of the reasons companies are pulling out of some of these states, or at least some of the areas, is that when the fund is basically funded by companies, and the companies have to take a piece of that risk in most states, at least. And so if, in fact, everything goes up, even the people, even if they say, well, I don't want to write those risks, they end up underwriting some of those risks by virtue of being part of the fund. And so that can be a real problem. And again, I think it's part of the reason that the companies, even when they pull out, if they pull out of a state and they're not writing any coverage, then they're not part of the fund anymore. But as long as they write any coverage in a state, they end up picking up a piece of that. And that, again, I think is part of what's driving rates up.
Greg, thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at insurance today with our guest, Mike Riley, Madison attorney. He represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation and arbitration, a partner in the Exley law firm in Madison. Tyler Dinner, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today as we visit with Michael Riley, a Madison attorney. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Carolyn in Sauk County up next. Let's go there. Hi, Carolyn.
Good morning. I recently, when we got our insurance bill for our homeowners, called an independent agent and asked if they could give me some different rates. And after they checked, they said no, because our building 50 plus years ago used to be a commercial property. It's rezoned personal or residential now. Why won't the insurance companies realize that? Why do they look back 50, 60 years ago to what it used to be?
Doesn't make any sense to me.
It makes absolutely no sense to me either. I'd love to give you some sage answer, but there isn't one coming from me anyway. Yeah, I mean, I talked to another agent, maybe talked to a couple of individual companies. I mean, we've got some good companies in the state like American Family, West Bend. I mean, there are many others. Sentry's a Wisconsin company, and wouldn't hurt to check with one or two of them as well, because that I just don't understand that. I don't see how that affects the nature of the risk at all. You're not using it for as a commercial enterprise. I mean, if you were, that makes a difference, because you got people coming and going, and you know, your trip and fall hazard, any of those things go up. But you're using it as a single family residence. It just, the fact that it once was commercial shouldn't affect it in my mind at all.
There you go, Carolyn. Check around a little bit. Jane in Waukesha, we'll go to you. Hi, Jane.
Question for you. I'm a condominium owner, and on my recent premium that is coming due on the homeowner's policy, it was suggested in talking with the independent insurance agent that a loss assessment be added to the policy to help offset costs after major damage to the building. And again, this kind of relates to an earlier caller's question about all the major claims that insurance companies are having to deal with, that this would be something to contemplate adding. And I didn't really quite understand how a loss assessment, what that does or how it works.
Well, I'm not sure I understand it completely either, but let me give you my take anyway. First of all, I think some of that stems from that horrific collapse of the condominium in Florida a few years back, where you know, the thing, and that, you know, would lead to a very substantial loss assessment. I mean, as I view loss assessments or assessments generally, I mean, we all pay, my wife and I live in a condo, we pay, you know, a fee every month. And part of that, you know, goes to create a pool to deal with things when you need new roofs or need new siding or whatever. And that, in addition to that, there's probably some amount that's set aside. So if you have some kind of catastrophic loss that's not covered by insurance, that, you know, you might have to pay into that. Now, it's honestly a little difficult to imagine what that would be. I mean, that would have to be something that didn't affect just your unit in the condominium complex, but the whole complex. So I suppose if you had a tornado or something, condominium insurance generally means the insurance on the exterior of the condominium is almost always the responsibility of the association. So they're responsible. For instance, if, you know, my roof is damaged, they have to replace that. If my siding is damaged by hail, they have to replace that. I'm responsible for anything within the condo. So anything on the inside of the condo, all my personal property, but beyond that, probably other elements of the inside of the condominium. So, you know, I would ask the agent to explain exactly what the loss assessment is for and why he believes you are at risk for some kind of loss assessment. And then always, you know, everything in insurance is cost risk. That's what it really is. You're saying, okay, how much is it going to cost me? What kind of a risk do I have? Do I want to spend X dollars to defray that risk, you know, and make sure I'm not going to be personally responsible? It's not something that I've run into, and I've handled a lot of claims for condominium owners, including claims where they're in a dispute with the condominium association about who's responsible for certain things. But I'd want a better explanation of exactly what the risk is he thinks you're insuring against. And then I think you can weigh the likelihood of that happening. It's not something that I've seen happen. As I said, the one thing that leaps to mind is that disaster in Florida. And obviously there, it was a huge problem because they had to replace the whole condominium in effect. And I think likely the insurance they had to cover the condominium didn't begin to be adequate. And that's the other thing. You should talk to your condo association and find out what coverage they have against that particular risk and see whether, again, that seems reasonable to you or whether you think you need to do something more.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. Jane, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Betty in Shawano has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Betty.
Hi, I have a question. I have a child that got an OWI, a first offense, when they were 17, and now they're 21. And I'm wondering, our insurance for auto went up a lot, obviously. But it said, when I looked up the expungement, there's no expungement in Wisconsin for even a first offense OWI. So does that mean for the rest of this kid's life, they're going to have to pay high insurance costs?
No, I don't think so. And in fact, I would have thought by now that if he's 21, he's still living at home, I assume, or still on your policy.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, the effect should diminish with time. And again, if it hasn't, or if the rates still seem extraordinarily high, I'd certainly check out the companies, go to an agent, you know, go to individual companies and just see what they'd offer. I mean, that's going to be there. And even if you had expungement, expungement's, you know, a legal term that sort of it takes away some of the consequences, but that record's probably not going to ever go away. I know we've looked at that before, and whether an insurance company would still have access to it, they might well. And I think you're right that Wisconsin doesn't allow expungement. It's one of those things where people are legitimately concerned about OWIs and the havoc that can be caused. You know, and unfortunately, what happens is people who make one mistake and do one thing ended up, you know, with more consequences than maybe is fair or reasonable. But that it stems from this overall desire to curb drunk driving. Doesn't do it very effectively, I don't think, but that's the idea. But again, that it should certainly lessen with time. Now, whether that means 21 or 25, I couldn't tell you. But again, it may mean different things to different companies. And if he's got a clean record ever since then, it just shouldn't be having a major impact on your family's insurance rates.
There you go, Betty. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Daniel in Milwaukee next. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Calling about umbrella insurance, and I'm wondering, when is it worth it to get umbrella insurance? And is there a rule of thumb for how much coverage one should get?
Sure, that's a great question. I mean, one, the first answer really is, look, you get umbrella insurance to protect yourself. It's also, of course, protects others if you injure them. But when you're getting an umbrella, you know, I think the primary focus really is, what assets do you have? I mean, if you have an underlying policy, and you do, obviously, or you wouldn't be asking about an umbrella, let's say you've got 100, 300, which is, in my view, the least anybody should really carry. If you have 100, 300, the odds that you're going to have an accident that goes beyond that are very small. And that's why umbrella policies are cheap, relatively, because the risk that the company's undertaking is very small. Because one, it's not likely you're going to have an accident where somebody's seriously injured. And two, that the notion that somebody would hold out and say, we're not going to just accept your policy limits, we want more from you personally, is relatively small. But so if you have very little in assets, you know, then is it, you know, do you need to get an umbrella? No, you don't need to get an umbrella for yourself. But if you have any meaningful, I mean, if your assets exceed your insurance coverage, so let's say you've got 100, 300, and in this day and age, you own a home, and that could easily be 300, 400, 700. You know, homes are just so expensive these days. And you have other assets as you go through life, you know, those assets are going to be at risk in the unlikely event you have that kind of accident. Is it worth spending a really pretty limited money for an umbrella policy? Yeah, because the chances that even if you have a catastrophic accident where there are horrible damages, and they're rare, but even if you have that, the chances that somebody would say, no, we're not going to accept the limits from your umbrella are real small. And one other point I should make at this point, when you have insurance, your company has to defend you. Now, Wisconsin has something that's called pay and walk, which means that if your company at some point just says, boy, this is too bad, I mean, there's no way we can get you out of this, they can put their limits on the table and then they don't have to defend you anymore. But companies don't do that readily. As a lawyer, when I've represented people in that situation, I really pressure the company because they have a duty of good faith and fair dealing. So to me, they can't just say at the first drop of a hat, say, okay, here's our money. You know, we'll throw it all on the table. And so it's important to have a policy. And again, if you have an umbrella policy, you've got that next layer, because if you have a bad accident and your company pays the $100, they don't have to defend you anymore. That's it. I mean, once they get to that point, they can walk away. Well, now you've got an umbrella company with a lot more coverage. They do have to defend you, and the chances they're going to just throw their money in are really so limited, you know, because those cases are so rare that, you know, I think you're buying yourself an extra measure of protection. And like with so much of insurance, I mean, how many of us have our houses burned down? You know, it's a rarity, but we still carry coverage. Now, some of it's because we have a mortgage, but, you know, even we haven't had a mortgage for a lot of years. We still carry homeowners because I don't want to run that risk, you know, and I think most people don't, even though the risk is very small. A lot of it's peace of mind, and that's what I think an umbrella policy gives you as well.
There you go, Daniel. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Mike in Sheboygan next. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've heard of the term called reinsurance. It's my understanding that insurance companies distribute their risk across bigger companies such as Lloyd's of London or Swiss Re. Is that correct to say that reinsurance is basically insurance for insurance companies, or is there another term for that?
No, I think that's exactly correct. I mean, what they're doing is they're spreading their risk just the way we do when we buy insurance. They don't want to carry, especially they don't want to have a risk that's concentrated in one particular line of business or one area of the country. And that's generally why they buy reinsurance. They don't, it's pretty much the way we buy underinsured motorist coverage, if you will, to protect us against an unusual event. They want to be in a position where if they have a really catastrophic year, and heaven knows the catastrophes become routine these days, that they have somebody to backstop them so they aren't effectively bankrupt by a bad year or a bad run of losses. And that you're right, it's really insurance for an insurance company.
Mike, thank you. Paul in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Paul.
Hello. My brother was driving down George Street in La Crosse, and a bus pulled out in front of him, and so he ended up hitting the bus. He was on a scooter. He ended up in the hospital with head injuries, maybe some brain injuries, a number of broken bones and ribs. And so he was in there for 5 weeks.
Oh, boy.
His wife and he got a hold of a lawyer, probably Wisconsin-wide lawyer firm, and they kind of said that he was only entitled to like $250,000, which was the city's insurance. At the time of the accident, he was tested for drugs. The driver wasn't, but was immediately fired. The police did not really do what they were supposed to. The driver was a CDL driver, was supposed to have the state patrol there. None of that happened. A lot of very unusual things. But the insurance company, the lawyers said all they could do was the city's insurance policy, which was $250,000. City and bus company insurance policy was $250,000. That doesn't seem right, because I see a lot of issues where people sue, and they get a lot more. So I don't know if they just got to find a different lawyer, or if maybe there is some thing that prevents them from getting, especially since there were so many errors on the part of city officials, police officials, and et cetera.
Yeah. Boy, that's a bad situation.
I'm so sorry. That's horrible. And there were a lot of good things about what I did for a living. But, you know, one of the really awful things is you see the horrible tragedies that happen. And as you're saying, I mean, there's nothing that would make that okay. No amount of money, even if it was $1 million. But the money helps. Money does mean something, and it does make a difference. So, first of all, let's just talk about the city and the exposure they have. Wisconsin, first of all, used to have immunity for just about everything for the state and a lot of the subdivisions. What they did is they passed a law that said that all political subdivisions can be sued, can be liable, but there are limits. And the first limit is $50,000. So the city generally, for instance, if you have a sidewalk that they don't bother to repair, even though they know it's defective and somebody trips and is injured, the city's maximum exposure for that is $50,000. You can't get more than that from them. When a motor vehicle is involved, as it was here, it's $250,000. So that amount is certainly better than the 50, obviously, but it's also, as you say, completely inadequate. I don't know, but having done enough of this work, 5 weeks in the hospital, I'm sure his medical bills are probably in that range. And leave alone the permanent damage that's been done to his lifestyle and his life and his family's life. And so, no, it's a completely inadequate amount. Yes, unfortunately, the law doesn't allow him to get more. I would really question in that case why he would need a lawyer at all. I mean, the city should simply pay him that money. Now, if they absolutely refuse or somehow claim they're not at fault, then certainly you do need a lawyer. But for somebody to take a large fee out of that money, to me, is troubling, because I just don't think, you know, and maybe they're not. Maybe they've simply told him, you know, what you should do is just tell him you'll take the $250,000. If that's the advice he's getting, I think, unfortunately, they're correct. But all of the other things that follow, and again, this isn't the first time I've heard any of these concerns, and it happens all the time. I will say, and my friends in the police department won't welcome it, but that truth's the truth. Police departments are not good at accident investigation at all. I think they're worse when you've got a local, you know, the municipalities involved, and you've got the local police involved. And even if the state patrol comes in, I'm not sure they do a much better job. It used to be, for instance, in Dane County, we used to have traffic police and regular sheriffs. And the traffic police were really good at that, because that's what they did. Now, in Madison, we don't enforce traffic laws at all to begin with in Madison. But I can't tell you how many times I see accident reports that are just completely wrong. You know, the officer didn't bother to take the time. It's a pain for them. They don't like to do it. They prefer not, especially if it's winter and they're outside. But the bottom line is they just don't spend a lot of time. Now, are there officers who do a great job? I'm sure there are. But I'm just telling you that it is routine to see accident investigations that are not very well done. Now, if at the end of the day, everybody agrees the bus company's at fault, I'm not sure it makes a great deal of difference. They fired the driver. You know, he could be charged criminally. You could go to the DA's office and say, why, district attorney, and say, why isn't he being charged criminally? If it was, you know, a gross negligence that caused this injury, I mean, he's not shielded from criminal liability as a city employee. He is shielded from personal liability as a city employee, because, you know, that the employee as well as the governmental entity is shielded by that law. But, you know, if you feel strongly about that, you know, that the appropriate person would probably be the district attorney to talk to and just see if he's willing to do anything. I have to say that in large part, they are reluctant, very reluctant to get involved in things like that. But it never hurts to try.
Paul, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Michael Riley, our guest Madison attorney with the Axley Law Firm of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at a variety of insurance issues, we've zeroed in on homeowners, rental, and auto insurance a bit with our guest, Michael Riley, Mike, a Madison attorney, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison. He's been with us many times. He always does a great job. And lots of callers online and some emails. Amy in Milwaukee emailed to ask, when renting a car, should you take out car insurance or will your own car insurance cover an accident if it should happen? Seems expensive when buying their insurance. Also, will your credit card cover an accident if you paid for the rental with it?
Yeah, the answer is, as always, I can give you a general answer. For the specifics, you'd need to check to be absolutely certain. Generally speaking, yes, your liability coverage will cover. Okay, so it's a temporary substitute vehicle under most policies, and that means that because you're not using your vehicle, obviously you're renting another one, you're not increasing their risk in terms of liability. You're still just driving a car. So that should be covered. I'd always, you know, worthwhile calling your own agent and saying, okay, I'm going to be renting a car. Am I going to be covered for liability? The bigger problem often is damage to the vehicle. So again, both the liability injury and probably damage to the other vehicle is covered under your policy. Check, but that's probably the case. The question is, how about coverage to the vehicle? Let's say you're at fault for the accident and you damage the vehicle you're renting. That's where, you know, it does provide additional protection. Your own car insurance may not cover that, but many credit cards do. So again, I just check. It's not every credit card, but a lot of the more upscale credit cards, if we want to put it that way, do cover that kind of thing. Cards like American Express and, you know, some of the up-end cards where you're getting the premium card or whatever. It's worth checking. And again, call, you know, your own credit card company and say, here's what's going on. Tell me what my rights are. Tell me what my coverage is. And they will. And then, you know, again, you have some peace of mind. Rental coverage is a ripoff. I mean, it is just disgustingly expensive. I once had somebody tell me, oh, this is really a good deal. I said, it's basically $20,000 a year. Nobody pays that for insurance coverage. And it is. It's grossly overpriced. It's one of those things I don't understand why they don't just offer you a rational price, which, of course, would lead you to say, okay, what the heck, for $5, I'll take it. You know, but it isn't. It, you know, ends up being about, sometimes it's about as much as the rental on the car is, you know, just for the insurance, which makes no sense. On the other hand, I had a partner years ago, wonderful guy, questionable judgment at times, did not take out coverage on a rental truck and promptly went under an overpass almost, but not quite, and it peeled back the top of the truck. And we spent quite a bit of time bailing him out of that particular fix. So, you know, particularly the damage to the vehicle you're renting would be a concern to me. So I check on those things.
Bob in Two Rivers has a question. Bob, hello.
Hello. Hi. About early 1990s, our son joined the Navy, and he had a car and was insured out of State Farm in Two Rivers. And some years later, he had a claim, and his address then was APO. It was a ship's name. But in military, they call it home of record. You have to have, I was in the military, I know that you need a home of record. But after they paid the claim, State Farm dropped him because they said the car was not kept in Wisconsin. Does he have any rights, or would he have had any rights to that?
Well, did State Farm cover the claim?
Yes, they would have covered the claim.
Yeah. Insurance companies can basically drop you for any reason they want. They can't do it because of race, creed, that kind of thing, but they can certainly do it because they just don't like, you know, the kind of car you're driving or the way you drive, or, you know, you're wearing a vest that day and they didn't care for it. I mean, they just don't have to offer a reason for dropping you, even though I'm sure that probably was the reason. And it does make a difference in the sense that if the car is being kept somewhere else, you know, that's a different risk. I mean, the risk of having a car in Los Angeles, California is not the same at all as Two Rivers, Wisconsin. So, you know, there is a rational basis for doing that, but they don't need a rational basis. They can just decide to do it.
And Carol, to kind of go along with this, Carol wonders how can she find an insurance company that she can trust? Her old company didn't do well, and she wants to know how she can tell if her new one is reputable.
Well, I wish I had a wonderful answer for that, Carol, but I'll give you the answer I have. One, you can check with the insurance commissioner's office. They have a log of claims. They should be able to tell you, and you probably can get it online. Go online and look at how many complaints a particular company has had in the state. And that's a start, at least. It's certainly not a great finish. It's not. And I have to tell you that I've dealt with insurance companies for 50 years now. And I go back to 40 plus of those years, I've represented people who were injured. Back in the day, 25, 30 years, and before that, I would say most companies were reasonably committed to trying to be fair. I'd say that that has changed dramatically for most companies, even the better companies, in the last 20, 25 years. I think that there is much less interest in fairness. There's much more interest in profit. I don't think that sets them apart from the rest of the world.
No,
that's probably very typical of corporate America these days. And, you know, that's not to condemn all companies or say they're all equal, because they're not. I certainly, from personal experience, professional experience, you know, I'd look at some state companies, you know, American Family, West Bend, who I happen to be insured with, Century. I think that there are other companies outside the state. I happen to be a fan of USAA. They've always seemed like a decent company. Amica seemed like a pretty good company. I have no axe to grind with any of them. You know, it's not that I don't get a commission from anybody. And I'm not saying that if you just go there, you'll be delighted. But I would say that the odds are better with those companies. I'm not a fan of the online companies. The companies that do a ton of advertising, we all know who they are. I can't say that I'm a big fan of those companies in terms of the service they provide. But it just, we're living in a world where the whole notion of service and fairness and everything else just has shifted. And the companies are no different than anyone else. But there are companies that are better than others. It's hard to know exactly how you determine that. Some of it's always, you know, when you're dealing with a company, it's the luck of the draw. Which adjuster did you get? Adjusters have the shots called by computers a lot more than they used to. I mean, they're used to have a lot more judgment. So maybe it made more difference back then. But even now, if you get the right adjuster, they're going to work to try to do the right thing. If you get the wrong adjuster, they're not. And some of that is something that can happen with any company, but probably is more likely to happen with some of the companies than others.
You know, I was thinking as you were talking, from the time I first got a car and got car insurance, I have been with American Family. So the same company my entire life, and the number of agents I've worked with were all from the same agency. The same one of them fellows died, and then another guy took over, and now his son is in there. And I've been with them the whole time. And they, in those cases, you know the agent.
And it does make a difference, Larry. It used to make a bigger difference. It used to be, you know, you could talk with an agent. You'd been with the company for a long time, and the agent would kind of go to bat, and the company would listen. I mean, they weren't going to cover something they absolutely didn't think was covered. But at the margin, it made a real difference. I don't think it makes as much difference, but it still helps. And it makes a big difference to have an agent you can trust and an agent you can go to and ask some of the questions we've talked about today, and you can trust that you'll get the right answer. One thing I will tell you, if you're going to the agent or a company and asking some of the questions we've been asked today, do it by email, get a response by email, because something that you discuss verbally, I mean, you can discuss it verbally, and I prefer talking to people on the phone, but at the end of the day, if you're going to rely on something, you ought to have it in writing. An email is fine.
Yeah. Tom in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Tom. You have a comment.
Hi there. I would agree about American Family 100%. The company that I have my house insurance and my auto insurance for four vehicles from family members, all right, that company left the state of Wisconsin, private insurance company. And as of February of this year, My broker through American Family found me another insurance company. And the amazing thing is, you know, everybody worries about doing this. Well, my insurance, the money I have to pay is roughly 55% of what I was paying annually to the other insurance company for exactly the same terms for both house insurance and auto insurance. So I'm saving. I have a new insurance company, but I'm saving 50%.
It's a great comment, and thanks for that. You know, we watch the ads on TV, and everybody says people who switch to, there's a reason, because companies aren't always the same. And that's why you should check. And as Larry says, you know, a lot of us, myself included, tend to just go with the same company. At some point, it's worth checking to see, because maybe you can get the same thing or maybe even better for less.
Yeah, good points. Tom, thank you very much for calling. Mike Riley is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back to take more of your insurance questions. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Michael Riley, talking about insurance with him. We've talked homeowners, we've talked auto insurance, and certainly you may have a question for us as well, and I hope you join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Maura in Longmont, Colorado has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mara.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a close friend that uses an extra vehicle that I have. She has no insurance of her own. She doesn't own a vehicle. And I was wondering what my liability might be if she were to get in an accident.
So a casual user of a vehicle.
Generally speaking, well, let's put it this way. I don't know what the law in Colorado is, although I suspect it's similar to Wisconsin. But again, you could check easily enough. I mean, usually you can actually just go online and say, is the owner liable for an accident when someone else is driving the car? First of all, if she's a permissive user of the vehicle and the vehicle's insured, she's almost certainly covered under your policy for that purpose. It depends a little bit on whether somehow they could argue that she's a uses it frequently. That might make a difference. In either case, you are almost certainly not personally liable. You wouldn't be in Wisconsin. We don't have owner liability. So you can lend your car to someone, and unless you're lending your car to someone who has 5 OWIs and has been in 6 accidents, which might change it, you generally aren't responsible for someone else's conduct when driving your vehicle. The way insurance works is the vehicle is almost always primary. So they would first, if I'm driving somebody else's vehicle, I cause an accident, they would first go to the insurance for that vehicle. Then if that weren't enough, then they could come to my insurance as excess. She doesn't have insurance, so obviously that isn't going to work. But likely your insurance company would cover her. You could check if you wanted, but in all likelihood, they would. And again, in all likelihood, you're not responsible, but you wouldn't be in Wisconsin. You'd need to check to be sure in Colorado. And I think if you just go online and type in that question, you'll probably get an answer. There are a lot of lawyers who put that information out online, kind of trolling for clients. So it's worth giving it a try.
And thanks, Mara, for calling. A listener called to ask ask you to talk about lawyers who don't charge unless they win. Is this a good option?
It is. I'm struggling for an appropriate word. Fraud seems a little strong. It's not that there's anything fundamentally dishonest about it. It's just that that's what all lawyers who handle personal injury cases do. We all work on what's called a contingency fee basis, which means we get a percentage of what's recovered. But, you know, the fact that you say that, I understand you can justify it by saying, well, people are concerned about, are they going to have to pay fees? And that's fine. But you know, to make it sound as if that's something special. It's not. That's what all lawyers who do personal injury work do, period. You know, I've never seen a lawyer who does personal injury work who doesn't charge on a contingency fee basis. And a contingency fee means exactly that. It's contingent on getting money for the people, and then you get a portion of that money. Talk about fees. I mean, the standard fee is generally a third. I think in a lot of cases, that's probably reasonable enough. I think there are cases, particularly where you have a very significant loss, where it's fair to ask if there's not some flexibility in that. I certainly have done that for clients where it seemed appropriate. You can't do it in every case or most cases, but you certainly can do it in cases where there's a very large loss and correspondingly a large fee. And also in cases where, you know, like that, where the amount of effort that's really involved is not extensive. I mean, there can be a very large case where you have to put incredible amounts of time and energy into it to recover. And again, that case is a third reasonable. But the question is, you could talk to different lawyers and see. One of the problems with the contingent fee system, and it's just inherent in the system, and it doesn't make it a bad system. We lawyers who support the system, and it's the system that's used everywhere in this country, just say, look, it gives you the keys to the courthouse, which means you don't have to go and pay a lawyer $10,000 to hire him.
Yeah.
You're not going to pay anything unless you recover. Lawyers don't take cases where they don't think they're going to recover. Let's face it. I mean, if you look at a case and say, this is a loser, you're probably not going to take it on a contingency fee basis. I've had people ask me occasionally, well, can I pay you to take it? And generally, I just say no. If I don't think it's a worthwhile case to take, you know, on a contingency fee basis, I don't want to take your money. Now, again, there might be cases where it's appropriate to do that, but I think they're relatively few and far between. The hard thing is when you get cases, and we see them all the time, where the loss is relatively small. Maybe it's a property loss, damage to your vehicle. Maybe it's a relatively minor injury. It's just not realistic or possible for a lawyer to take those on a contingency fee basis because, you know,
yeah,
there's just not enough money there for really either for you or for the lawyer. But from the lawyer's standpoint, you know, it's just not something that's practical.
Jorge and Madison, your turn. Hi.
Larry, thanks for taking my call. It's George the dog trainer from Divine Canine. How are you, buddy?
Oh, George. Okay. It's good to talk to you. What's on your mind today?
He's probably hoping he can train me to do a little better.
No, my question is, you know, in working with dogs, a lot of times there's insurance for homeowners or apartments where they do discriminate against certain breeds. And people will tend to sort of just fib the truth about what breed their dog is. Now, in the event nothing happens, obviously nothing happens. But in the event something does happen, you know, what's the worst that could happen by, not telling the truth about the breed or not knowing the breed of the dog and not submitting a DNA test? And then the follow up question would be, what insurance companies that you know of are more open arm policy about accepting dogs on their insurance policies?
Those are great questions, and I'm really glad you called. I mean, first of all, I don't think if you simply don't know the breed and you don't misrepresent it, or you honestly believe it's a Labrador and in fact, you know, it's something else, you know, less benign, although most dog bites by number are labs because they're the largest dogs by number,
yeah.
Even though labs have great dispositions generally. If you did deliberately misrepresent, the consequence could be no coverage because the company could say that's a material misrepresentation. We accepted the risk based on your representation that this was a form of dog that is not prone to attack. And I know as a dog trainer, I suspect you'd say, look, none of the breeds are not necessarily dangerous if, you know, they're properly trained. But that's the problem. Some breeds, you know, I know the knock on pit bulls, or one of the knocks on pit bulls, is, you know, once they do attack, they just don't stop. And again, I'm sure that's not universally true, but I think it does, my understanding, and you would know better than I, that is kind of a breed characteristic. And there are some breeds that people, and maybe it's a product of just the way those breeds have been socialized. I don't know how much of that is breeding or training or whatever. But the bottom line is, if you've got a dog and you want to be insured, you better not lie about what the breed of that dog is, because that could be disastrous for you. The other thing I'd say is you should make sure you check with the company about exactly what coverage you've got for a dog, because you can have your, and this is under your homeowners. That's where your dog, something that your dog did would be covered is under your homeowner's policy or renter's policy. And one of the problems is a lot of the companies now will limit coverage for a dog bite. You know, you may have $100,000 in coverage, which is kind of standard in most homeowners' policies, but they may reduce that to $25,000 for a dog bite. So, you know, if you're when you're picking the company, you should be careful you understand exactly what coverage you're going to get for that. I don't know in terms of companies. I honestly don't know. I think that's one of those things where you really would just have to go company to company and check and make sure you understand what their policy is about dogs, what it says expressly about dogs. You know, I think that's the biggest thing. What limit of coverage are they giving you? Are they going to reduce that? Because some companies do, not all companies.
There you go, George. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary emailed to ask if you can talk about homeowners insurance and renters insurance when it comes to water damage from storms, whether it's flooding or backup storm sewers. She believes sometimes you're covered and sometimes you're not, and it's all very confusing. And I remember somebody called. We were talking about flooding, and somebody called from, I forget the town now. It might have been Wausau, but I'm not positive, that they're in some areas of the city, they were required to take flood insurance. Oh. However, they would never collect on it because the flood, the water damage is always from seepage.
Yeah. Yeah, flood insurance usually means you're in a floodplain. If you're not in a floodplain, then normally flood insurance, I mean, a flood, if you just get a heavy storm and you get water, Larry and I were talking previously, I got bought a home when I first moved back to Madison from Phoenix, and lo and behold, it wasn't graded properly, and we had a big rainstorm, and I mean, I was carrying buckets out of the basement. I looked like the Mickey Mouse, the original Mickey Mouse movie, you know, The Sorcerer's Apprentice. And it's a miserable feeling. It's just awful. Generally speaking, and again, I'd always talk to your agent and make sure that your company does it. I don't think most companies would refuse coverage for that. I don't know about the backed up sewer. We had that wonderful experience, too. And I think that that is covered. But again, I check with your agent to be sure. Because, again, companies differ. Companies just do things a bit differently. I think most companies, though, the fact that you have a rainstorm and that ends up causing damage should fall within your coverage generally. And let me just say a word about renters real quickly, Larry, because I know that's come up a couple times. Renters insurance is important when it comes up. It can come up for you, obviously. It also comes up for a lot of people with kids. Kids go to college. They rent. And what almost invariably when kids rent, when they're at college, you sign something saying, okay, we're responsible. And I can't tell you how many cases I've had where kids left the pizza box on the stove and poof, you know, and all of a sudden you got a fire and it destroys, you know, a part of the premises. You can be liable for that. And renter's insurance is one of the things that will cover that. It also, you know, covers a lot of your own possessions. But I think particularly for a parent, one of the big concerns is if you don't have renter's insurance and the kids do damage through their own negligence, perhaps intention, but, you know, through negligence most often, you could be on the hook for that. So it's something that's worth taking a look at.
Someone else wondered about timeshares. In a timeshare situation and wants to get out of it, that's a totally different thing, I guess, than what we're talking about today. But
yeah, that's really interesting because we actually owned a timeshare out in when we were in first in Montana out there, and we had an eighth interest in the place. And As I recall, I thought that was all included in the time, what we were paying for the timeshare, that, you know, we paid dues and things. And I think that includes insurance. But again, I'd always, I'm a big proponent of asking if you've got a timeshare and you're not sure, talk to whoever's in charge of that and make sure that you don't. My suspicion is you'd need, see, with timeshares, I mean, generally, obviously, you don't have your own furniture or anything else in there. I mean, you bring your clothing with you and everything when you go, but there really isn't anything there that belongs to you other than the right to use it for a limited amount of time each year. So I wouldn't expect you to be responsible for that insurance, but again, it's always worth checking.
Yeah, I think in this case, the person wanted to get out of the timeshare and didn't know how to get out of the
timeshare. Oh, well, okay. Well, all you have to do is flip on the radio and listen. There's about three outfits now who are advertising they'll get you out of the timeshare, and if they don't, you won't have to pay anything. I go online and just say, you know, timeshare cancellation. That's what they call it, the timeshare cancellation industry. And there must be things you can do to get out of them because they're running ads very regularly. So I'm sure there's somebody there who'll be happy to help you and will tell you they won't charge you unless they get you out.
And Jill's reminding me, or Clara maybe, I think Jill is reminding me that we did talk about flood insurance, and the program was on February 15th. So if anybody wants to go back to February 15th and ideas at WPR.org/Larry, we went into that extensively. A listener emailed, she asked her insurance company about lowering her coverage, and they refused to even consider it. They said it was because they could be sued for compensation for inadequate coverage. Can an insurance company be liable if a driver is sued for an at-fault accident, like they stated as their reason for denying her request? Also, is it legal for an insurance company to deny you coverage at the rate you want? Well, yeah, I would.
Yeah, they can deny you coverage, as I said, for any reason they choose to deny coverage. That reason seems fanciful to me. I mean, I've never heard of that. I don't believe a company, you know, companies write minimum limits policies all the time and arguably write them in cases where it makes no sense at all because the person has assets and certainly shouldn't have a minimum. I mean, I had a client just a couple of years ago who had $100,000 and had millions and millions in assets. I mean, that's insane. But is the company legally responsible for that? I've never seen anything that suggests that's the case.
Cheryl emailed, they have a home with an umbrella insurance company on it. They have also have a couple of rental houses with business policies on them. And she's wondering if it would behoove them to add umbrella policies to the business policies on the rental homes.
Well, some of that depends. If the business is incorporated, I mean, you still have assets in the business, but then your personal liability would be limited to the assets of the corporation, likely. So, I mean, you couldn't come after your home and other things. And again, that's, you know, always worth talking to somebody who does. I don't do business law. That's not my area at all. But generally speaking, that's why you incorporate, or part of why you incorporate, is to buy that legal protection. I think it depends on, you know, one, the value of the properties, what their interest in the property is, their equity. And then I think you'd look at that and say, OK, one, how much liability do we have? And again, I think people tend to assume that the potential liability is a lot greater than it is. I mean, how long have you owned these properties? Have you ever had a claim? How bad do you think it could be? I mean, you're really talking about pretty limited number of things. I mean, maybe a trip and fall on the premises. I mean, if there was something on the inside that was a problem. But it's hard to imagine a huge loss. Almost all catastrophic losses come from car accidents. I mean, that's the vast, vast majority. But again, it doesn't cost much. I'd check on that, see what you think your interest is, how much it's worth. What coverage do you already have? Because again, the risk of somebody being injured is far greater than the risk of somebody being injured so badly you'd need an umbrella policy. I'm a big proponent of umbrellas. That one seems to me to be a bit of a stretch, but it's certainly worth checking.
John in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you. Is it better to have an insurance company that's registered in the state of Wisconsin as opposed to an insurance company that's from another state?
Well, all companies have to be authorized to do business in the state. I mean, you can't do business in the state of Wisconsin as an insurance company unless the insurance commissioner has authorized you to do that. So in that sense, everybody is at least authorized to do business. Do I think local companies, it's worth at least checking first there? I do. If there are some fine companies from other states, it's not like it's limited to Wisconsin. I mentioned a cup. I mentioned USAA and Amica, both of whom I think are generally good companies. But, you know, we've got some very good companies in the state, American Family, West Bend. I mentioned Century. There are a number of smaller mutual companies in the state, Wisconsin Mutual here in Madison. I mean, there are a lot of good companies in this state. And I do think it's not night and day, but I do think on the whole, is there an advantage to have a local company? Yes, I think there is an advantage.
John, thank you very much for calling. Home insurance, how much, what should your home insurance policy cover?
Well, I think the most important thing probably is replacement cost coverage, to be sure that that's the kind of coverage you have. I think most policies are replacement costs, but that just means you don't want your home to be insured at a certain level, and then, you know, gosh, now, just over 5-10 years, that kind of doubled, and you want to make sure that that's being properly covered. Homeowners coverage also covers certain kinds of liability. We talked about dogs a little bit ago, and if you are a homeowner and own a dog, that should be covered under your policy if your dog injures someone. And that's most dog injuries are not severe, but they can be awful. I had a case not too many years ago where a young girl literally had her nose bitten off. Oh. And they were able to do, I thought the reconstructive surgeons did an incredible job, but it still was, I mean, it was a horrible event. And obviously it was, the claim was a very significant, the medical bills were huge, and she still had, you know, some change in her appearance. So it's a lot of money. So make sure your liability limits are adequate. The standard tends to be 100. Again, I don't think that's enough. I don't think it costs that much to raise it, assuming the company will do that. It's always worth checking. How much is it going to cost you? If the difference is very small, for heaven's sakes, take the higher limit. You're not likely to need it, but why not protect yourself in the event that something awful that nobody anticipates happens? Yeah, you know, I think those are really the critical things. I mean, that's really the critical element. You've got the insurance that covers your property, covers the home itself and the contents, and then you've got the liability coverage that covers, you know, if something happens on your home or if you commit a negligent act. We've talked about sports events, and if you did that, if you're a coach and you do some silly thing and somebody gets injured as a direct result, those risks are very small. And the liability portion of the coverage is not the expensive part of the coverage. I mean, it's the home, really, and the damage to the home, because that's where the bigger risk lies.
Just one final word here. A listener emailed in that the top three states for storm damage claims in 2023 were Florida, Louisiana, and right next door, Iowa.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, I somebody was talking about something in Iowa the other day that truly amazed me. I always think of Iowa as being, you know, kind of our little brother, not quite as nice as we are, but, you know, or as Minnesota, but, you know, really pretty nice. Never thought they'd have that kind of damage.
On that note, we are out of time, Mike. I want to thank you once again. I learned a lot, and I think our listeners did as well. Appreciate it. I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
I'd love to. I always learn all sorts of things from your listeners, and it usually sends me back to my office to look at things and see what it was I couldn't answer.
Mike Riley, Michael Riley, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison, and he will be back, and we will talk with him again, I'm sure. And thanks for all your great questions as well. Boy, tomorrow is Friday already, and that's Garden Talk time. VJ Pandian will be back to talk about pruning fruit trees and growing in a changing climate. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller.